Hey, and welcome back to Forecast, the show about climate science and climate scientists. I'm Mike White, Nature's editor for Climate Science. Well, it's the week after AGU. It was a massive and overwhelming meeting, as always. For once, I didn't get sick during AGU, and that was a major advance. And it was, as you can imagine, a meeting with a pretty different feeling from previous AGUs. The incoming U.S. administration has been making a lot of noise about their support for climate science, and the appointments to the cabinet kind of suggest that there may be some fairly major changes coming down the road. So my old friends and colleagues from agencies like NASA and DOE are feeling pretty concerned, justifiably so. I think who knows what's actually going to happen, but the present mood is one that's fairly, I wouldn't say grim or defeatist, just concerned, but also fairly full of resistance. There was a pretty large rally to support science, and there were far more sessions at AGU than there have been in the past about how organizations like AGU can support science. Governor Jerry Brown gave a rabble-rousing talk about how states can step in to fill any kind of gaps that might be coming about from change in federal funding policies. So from those points of view, it was actually pretty interesting. And today, I'm bringing you an interview with Josh Willis, who is a NASA scientist from the Jet Propulsion Laboratories in Pasadena, California. I think I met Josh back in 2010 when I was doing a series of lab visits in Los Angeles. But I was aware of his work. We discussed a couple of his papers from 2006, 2007 that I actually included in my Nature application back in, I guess it was 2008 when I applied. The application asked you to propose and just discuss a couple of interesting papers and how you think they present interesting editorial issues. So Josh and I talked for a fair amount about those two papers from 06, 07 about ocean heat content. In other news, I think I've mentioned this previously, but I'm reaching out more into climate economics. And as part of that, I'm going to the American Economic Association meeting in Chicago in early January. Not a good time of year to go, but should be interesting. I'll also visit the University of Chicago and Northwestern University. So I'm looking forward to those visits. And yeah, Josh and I sort of start off with a quick chat about recording for these kinds of podcasts. And Josh apparently has a gigantic pillow fortress set up for doing recordings in his house. And I have a fairly elaborate contraption here in my home office and a converted garage. This is my interview with Josh Willis from NASA JPL. How's your pillow fortress coming along?
Your audio is going to sound better than mine. I didn't quite get my pillow fortress to that level.
Yeah, you wouldn't believe my setup. I'm at home in my converted garage, and I have a piece of foam insulation wrapped around my microphone, and then I have this contraption worked up with a Pendleton blanket hanging from the ceiling, and then it's tensioned to provide this triangular enclosure around the microphone.
That's beautiful. That's a work of art.
Mm-hmm. So are you headed to AGU?
I am not headed to AGU, actually.
Congratulations.
Thank you. It was such a busy year for me that I just decided all I had was a poster and kind of everything else that I wanted. A bunch of other stuff is covered by other people, and so I'm sitting this one out.
So where are you from? Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Dallas, Texas, or just outside of Dallas, and moved to California right after college to follow my future wife.
Oh, interesting. Did you meet her when you're at the University of Houston for your undergrad?
I did, yes. Yes, we met at the University of Houston in the honors program there, which turned out to be this amazing little program inside the confines of a gigantic public university. We got a really amazing education there and met. And yeah, she was from San Diego and moved back out here to go to medical school in LA. And I went to San Diego to be near her family strategically.
Good move.
Thank you.
So she was in medical school in LA. You were in San Diego. And so I guess that's not that long of a...
It's not too bad.
Long distance relationship. Bad. Yeah.
Yeah.
How did she like being in Houston compared to growing up in California?
I love California. I grew up in Texas. It was okay, but I consider myself a Californian now. I really love it.
Tell me the worst joke about Texans that you know.
Oh, the worst joke about Texans.
I'm from New Mexico. Kind of, I grew up in New Mexico, so there's a lot of jokes about Texans.
The one that I always say when I'm out and about is Texas is a great place to be from.
You know, I just heard Laura Wilcox say that about Reading in the UK.
Oh, really?
Okay, I'm going to tell you the joke about Texans and skiing for listeners out there. This is going to be kind of salty language, so you know, cover your ears for the next 15 seconds. It's more of a saying than a joke, and the saying is, if God had wanted Texans to ski, he would have made bullshit white. That's harsh, right?
I think it was Mark Twain. Somebody, one of those old guys, said, if I owned hell in Texas, I'd rent out hell and live in... No, I'd rent out Texas and live in hell. That's what it was.
I had relatives from Dallas, so I went there numerous times when I was a kid, and you know, I guess my memories of it are going to malls, the appalling heat, and just the vast sprawl. So I guess coming to California in your early 20s must have been kind of a delight.
It was fun. It still is fun. I love living in Los Angeles, and I love California. It's neat to be someplace where the ocean is close to the mountains, and you can drive through like 8 different climates in 2 hours. It's cool.
Yeah, oh, it's amazing. Your first 2 degrees, your bachelor's and your master's, are both in physics. What flavor of physics was that when you were at Houston in this honors program? And then what did you transition to when you were at UCSD?
I got an undergraduate degree in physics, as you say. And when I was there at the University of Houston, I did some work on condensed matter physics. Turns out at the time, there was a very small NASA outpost at the University of Houston working on...
Oh, I didn't know
It was interesting. They were trying to build semiconductors on the back of a big disk flying through space in the low Earth atmosphere in order to create a really high-quality vacuum behind it. It's called the Space Vacuum Epitaxy Center. Typical NASA name. It was exciting stuff. It kind of got me a little bit of a flavor for what it was like to do research. Then at University of California, San Diego, UCSD, I was actually going for a PhD, and it took me a while to kind of figure out what I wanted to do, and I guess in the end I never really found it in physics. I did astronomy for a little while, and that didn't suit me so well, and then actually in the end I failed out of the physics program at UCSD. I did not get my...
Congratulations.
PhD. Thank you.
Wow. How do you fail out of a master's program? Does it take a lot of work?
It does. It's a special kind of failing out. they have a departmental exam or a series of exams, and I didn't pass the exams. So they kind of gave me the master's as a consolation prize and said, please move along to the next graduate program somewhere else.
How were you feeling at the time? I guess sometimes when you fail at something like that, it can be a huge relief because it's a confirmation that maybe what you thought all along but didn't want to admit was actually true.
It was a huge relief, but it took me a year or two to realize it. You know, I was young and I really thought I wanted to be a physicist.
Yeah.
And it was hard for a year or so. I was really fortunate because I found the Scripps Institution of Oceanography right down the hill at UCSD. And they were doing all this really exciting climate research and oceanography, and I jumped into it and I realized, wow, this is really the place for me. It wasn't very long before I was super happy that I had moved.
That would have been in the late 1990s and early 2000s. What kind of work was going on at Scripps then that you found so interesting, and who were the initial inspirations there?
Well, I started working for my eventual advisor. His name is Dean Remick. Mm-hmm. He was interested in combining data directly taken from the ocean, in situ data collected from ships, with this still fairly new satellite called Topex Poseidon. It's the first satellite that very accurately measured the height of the ocean. And the height of the ocean changes whenever there's warm water. So if there's a bunch of warm water, the water literally stands taller.
Just because the density changes.
Just because the density changes, exactly. So I set about trying to combine these two data sets in a small area around Australia, between Australia and New Zealand, called the Tasman Sea.
Right.
Which my advisor was a place that he was studying and found interesting. And then right after that, I wrote one paper. And then after that, my advisor said, so what do you want to do now? He said, you know, is there some place in particular you find interesting or you want to study? And I said, well, I think I'd kind of like to do the same calculation, but for the whole world.
Nah,
he
dang.
Said, are you sure? He's like, are you sure? That sounds like a lot of work. I said, yeah, I think that would be really exciting because it'll tell us something about how much the oceans are warming, and that's important for climate change and global warming. And he said, okay, good luck. I'll see you in a year. And it took me a while. It was a lot of work, but then I eventually did a calculation estimating how much the oceans had warmed in a decade. That was sort of the start of my career of looking at ocean warming and sea level rise.
What did you learn from Dean? What kind of an advisor was he?
Oh, Dean was great. He was a very, I don't want to say hands-off advisor. He was always around when I needed him. But he really gave me a lot of freedom to go in directions I found interesting. Didn't put a lot of pressure on me to tackle specific problems. He really helped me grow as a scientist. He was a fantastic advisor, really. Perfect for me. He wasn't always there cheering me on from the sidelines either, you know. It required
right.
a lot of self-motivation.
Which could work super well for some people and not for others.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. And for me and where I was, it was right on the money. And he's been a great advisor and colleague and an advocate ever since grad school.
Is he retiring soon?
He is. He's looking to retire pretty soon. Of course, now he's deeply involved in a leadership position in the ARGO program,
mm-hmm.
very important program for measuring temperatures and salinities of the ocean all around the world with these robotic floats.
I guess you're around at the dawn of ARGO and involved in ocean heat content work around that time. What did it seem like to you when it got going? I mean, it's what are these observational tools that we now have that, you know, we used to have the XBTs and things like that, but there was just this gaping hole in knowledge and in data.
It was super exciting. You know, it was one of those, it was also kind of scary. It was one of those things, well, if this works, it will be amazing.
Yeah.
because it required a huge collaboration across all these different countries. There's something like 20 or 30 countries contributing floats.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a few big ones, but all the smaller players are important. If you didn't have the tail of the distribution, it wouldn't really be a global array. And it is. And, you know, I think they have thousands of publications now that have been drawn from ARGO data. So it's an incredibly powerful tool.
And now going into a deep ARGO and ARGO biogeochemistry too, the program is just expanding and expanding.
It is. It's a great idea. And, you know, in retrospect, it seems obvious. But at the time, it was almost crazy.
What was the, or was there a single event that galvanized the community to say, okay, look, we really need to collaborate on this. Let's get going.
Dean would know that better. You know, he's been also a great politician for ARGO.
Yeah.
Really the person behind getting all of the other countries to contribute. There were also some, you know, early issues about whether or not countries wanted data from their exclusive economic zones transmitted around the world. So, you know, there were legal issues, there were support issues, as always. There were a lot of challenges, but I think he just kind of ground away at all of them. And a team, you know, there have been a lot of other folks who've been instrumental to ARGO as well. But they kind of ground away at all those issues. I think it was a sort of a slowly creeping across the finish line kind of deal.
You know, one issue that bedevils or is a feature of all kinds of science is that you're going to have uncertainties and corrections to data sets all throughout the preparation and then subsequent reanalysis of those data. And you've been involved in some interesting developments with identifying some of these issues with data sets and discontinuities and time-varying biases. And you had a couple of papers with John Lyman in 2006, 2007, where you initially found this cooling in the upper ocean and then realized that there was a problem with the underlying data. Can you talk through what it was like sort of initially finding that cooling and then realizing that there had been this issue and how you went about addressing that?
Oh, yeah. this happened when I was just fresh out of graduate school. I was brand new at JPL as a postdoc, actually. And so it was a little terrifying. I'd been publishing papers on ocean warming all through my graduate career. There was warming, and then all of a sudden we recalculated after a couple years of new data, and there's this huge cooling signal. And it was hard to believe, and it it turned out that it was two different problems, and that was part of the reason it was so hard to detect. Mm-hmm. It was two different problems kind of lining up in a perfect storm of bad science, I guess. And what happened was essentially that the old data, the XBTs...
These are these expendable bathythermographs or something like that.
That's exactly right, expendable bathythermographs. And they're disposable instruments. They weren't really designed for climate, but if you collect enough of them and you're careful enough with how you use them, then you can see climate signals. And so we had been using these data all through the 90s and even earlier, but they had gotten biased warm. They had a warm bias. And so when all the Argo data started to come in, it was a correction downward toward cooling from the warm XBTs.
Yeah.
But then there was another problem because the Argo floats by themselves also showed cooling. If you just threw out all the XBTs and you only used Argo, you still saw global cooling. It was a real puzzle, and so we wound up publishing this paper that showed the cooling.
In GRL,
right. Even though we knew it was, you know, it was weird.
Kind of shocking, right? I mean, it got a lot of attention at the time.
It did, yeah, it did. So not all of it wanted attention. Rush Limbaugh talked about it. He actually had this great quote. He said, it was a funny quote. He said, to overturn the world economy based on the musings of a few idiot leftist scientists is just stupid, and that's what global warming is actually all about. So,
you've really made it, Josh.
Thank you. Thank you. I've been practicing that, in case you haven't told. Rush talked about our cooling paper. Then there was a paper kind of along another paper at about the same time that suggested that the XBTs were biased warm. But we still had this issue where there was cooling in the Argo data. And one night, it was Valentine's Day, I guess 2006. I can't quite remember the timeline anymore.
And you were married at this point.
I was married at this point.
An awesome way to celebrate Valentine's Day, discovery of a shocking error.
Exactly. We were literally walking out the door to go have dinner together, my wife and I, and I was looking at a few last calculations. I had a talk at NCAR the next Monday. It was a Friday night. We were going out. I finally isolated this one particular set of floats in the Atlantic that looked too cold. And I sent an email, an urgent, desperate email to my friend John Gilson, who works with Dean Rimmick at Scripps. And I said, John, do these floats look okay? And he wrote back and he said, no, those floats, there is something terribly wrong with them. Don't use those floats.
Were they just in a cluster in the North Atlantic or something like this?
They were all over the North. They were all over the Atlantic. I think some were in the South. They were in the North Atlantic. They were spread all across the Atlantic Ocean. And I turned to my wife and I said, I think global cooling might be wrong. And she said, "Well, we're going to dinner no matter what.
Get in the car.
You're not gonna ruin Valentine's Day." So we went to dinner, and I was just completely distracted the whole time. And I eventually spent the rest of the weekend revising my talk, saying, "Well, maybe global cooling is not real." And as it happened, it wasn't. This set of floats had it wasn't actually measuring too cold. It was measuring too shallow.
So the pressure sensor was off.
Exactly. The pressure sensors were off. It was a software issue. The sensors were working right, but the way the data was reported back put the temperatures at a shallower depth than they should have been, and that made it look colder. And so we wound up identifying all these floats, but I had ruined Valentine's Day, and so as retribution, my wife had business cards made that have my job title as idiot leftist scientist.
Do you still have any of those?
I do still have those, yes.
Your wife clearly has a good sense of humor.
She does.
I think this is one of the fundamental misperceptions that some people have about the way that science works is that scientists have a preferred explanation for the way the world works, and they pursue work in order to confirm that impression. I mean, of course, there is confirmation bias, but you know, you guys went out on a limb saying that there was this cooling, and then pretty much right away, you know, readily admitted that there had been this issue in your case with the software, and then published your correction right away.
Yeah, right. We worked hard to publish the correction. We were skeptical of the result to begin with, but the fact that I saw it in the Argo data as well as the combination of Argo and XBT data Really what finally did it was we finally got enough of the new data. Once we really had two full years of data, it started to become clearer that in the Argo data, all the cooling was in the Atlantic. And that was suspicious.
Yeah.
And it also started to diverge from the satellite measurements, the sea surface height measurements. And that was another indicator that something was wrong. And eventually, we were able to use the sea surface height observations to kind of very specifically identify exactly which floats were having problems.
Yeah.
And now, you know, they've, of course, fixed the problems. And, you know, some of the floats had to be eliminated. But some of them actually, they could recalculate what the correct pressure was supposed to be and sort of salvage those profiles.
Then in 2010, you, and I think John Lyman was the first author, had a paper in Nature that said robust warming of the global ocean. And that seemed to kind of kickstart a lot more interest in the idea that we need to be focusing more on the oceans as the repository of a lot of the energy that's staying in the climate system.
That's right. And also that, you know, once we found the warm bias in the XBT data, there's been a huge concerted effort, it's actually still ongoing, to correct the XBTs so that the biases that are there are removed, and we get a clean record of ocean warming even back before Argo.
I've heard Katya Dominguez give maybe two or three talks on this, and whenever I hear her talk, it seems like there's some some new issue that's been identified. And it's just this, well, maybe not endless, but it's an ongoing process of identifying and correcting the biases. But I think that's just inevitable when you're trying to build a climate record and bridging together the XBT with the Argo. Do you see any way around that, or do you see it ever reaching a conclusion?
Well, I think it's maybe it's reaching an asymptote.
Diminishing returns, yeah.
Conclusion, yeah, well, it might be strong, but I feel like we're honing in now, and we're correcting smaller and smaller errors. Kind of the point of that Lyman paper about robust warming was that, well, we know there are errors in the XBT data, and we're doing our best to remove them, but even if you account for the errors and you understand them and you put a slap a really big error bar on them, the warming is robust relative to even the errors in the XBTs.
I talked to Kevin Trenberth from NCAR at the recent CLIVAR meeting in Qingdao, China. And he was making the argument that that the community should be focusing on using the Argo data in a reanalysis sense and not trying to grid the observations directly. So we take all of our weather observations, our vertical soundings, and put it into a reanalysis and develop a three-dimensional field for the atmosphere. And his point was that the Argo data could be better used or used in a very productive way by putting those data into more formal ocean reanalysis to come up with the three-dimensional fields for the ocean as opposed to trying to work with the Argo data themselves. At least that's what I remember him saying. What are your views on an approach like that as a complement to the data themselves?
Well, yeah, I think it's great to pursue reanalyses. Argo data are being used in reanalyses already in several of them. I think, though, that you have to be a little careful with the reanalysis because it's not only using Argo data. It's using other data. Specifically, the data that reanalyses use are estimates of the heat exchange between the ocean and the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. It turns out that it's really hard to build an ocean model that can reconcile the heat exchange at the surface with all of the temperature data. In my opinion, reanalysis models aren't quite there yet. You really introduce some big errors with the forcing, with this heat exchange at the surface, that you can't necessarily correct entirely with the Argo data, at least not without kind of grossly violating the physics of the ocean. And if you think about it for a second, it kind of makes sense. It takes years for the heat to get from the surface down to kind of the mid-depth ocean, in some case, decades. So you have to have the Argo data kind of constantly correcting the errors that are put in at the surface from errors in the forcing. They have to be constantly correcting it, and they have to do that for decades in order to completely reconcile the heat exchange, to correct the errors in the heat exchange, and to be consistent with Argo, and also to not violate the physics of the ocean, right? You know, we kind of know how fast and what direction currents are going and how much vertical exchange there is and how fast. signals kind of diffuse down through the ocean. And it's hard to reconcile the physics that we understand, the temperature data below the surface, and the heat exchange at the surface. And I don't think there are any reanalysis models that really reconcile all three. Kevin may claim that there are some, but I'm not convinced yet.
Is the issue at the air-sea exchange down to factors like wind and wave dynamics, or is it something else?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are unresolved physical processes. Of course, the ocean models don't have grid cells small enough to have a single wave in them.
Yeah, right. So it's all parameterized.
Right. It's all parameterized. I think the issue is that there are these biases in the heat exchange. If you're always putting just a little too much heat in the ocean or not quite enough heat in the ocean, and you keep doing that year after year after year, then you accumulate this error. Mm-hmm. In heat in the ocean. And you really have to clamp the data very hard to subsurface temperature profiles. You have to clamp the models to those subsurface temperature profiles so hard that you wind up violating the physics in the upper ocean.
That sounds vexing.
It is, yeah. So you can kind of have two out of three. You can either have the physics right and the subsurface temperature right and mess up the flux, or you can have the flux and the sub. Anyway, you can kind of have two out of three, but nobody's really getting all of them.
Something else where you can bring these multiple lines of evidence, as you talked about, is using the ocean heat content in combination with the sea surface heights that you get from the satellite altimetry to try and track regional variations in sea level and then understand the atmospheric dynamics that are responsible for some of that. And you've published, for example, on how the El Nino Southern Oscillation or El Nino events can redistribute massive amounts of water from oceans to land and vice versa. And I guess we know one center that you would be looking at this from the heat content and also the topography would be the Western Pacific Warm Pool and how that changes in El Nino cycles. Can you talk about how you initially got into this work and what that led to in terms of our understanding of how sea levels vary interannually?
In 2010, there was this really interesting signal in sea level. It dropped. And it was not a small drop. It was significant. It was about a centimeter. And if you think about...
That's like 3 years of long-term sea level rise from the trend, right, but right. All happening in one year. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, remember, the oceans are two-thirds of the planet's surface. So two-thirds of the planet's surface dropped by a centimeter. That's how much water was left the ocean.
Right.
We saw it in the altimeter data, and we saw it in GRACE.
The gravity measuring satellite.
Exactly. GRACE, it essentially weighs different spots on the Earth. There's two satellites that chase each other around. As they move closer together and farther apart, you can infer the pull of gravity, the acceleration from gravity.
GRACE is so cool.
It is cool. Yeah, that's right. It's the most fun to explain because you get to use your hands and all this stuff. GRACE measured that the whole ocean area lost mass. So it was not a thermal expansion thing where the ocean cooled. Literally, water left the ocean. The interesting work was trying to figure out, well, where did it go? Mm-hmm. It turns out a lot of it went to Australia. There was some redistribution in South America and Brazil and Southeast Asia as well. But really the big signal was in Australia. And it was because when the water landed there, when all the rain and flooding happened there, there are these huge basins that kind of take a while to drain back off into the ocean.
Yeah.
You know, when it rains in Brazil, the Amazon carries the water out so quickly back out to the ocean that you don't see much sea level signal. You can see a little one, but not a big one. But in Australia, the water doesn't immediately run back off to the ocean.
Uh-huh.
So there's a much bigger time lag, and it turns out that a lot of the water got kind of stored in Australia. It eventually came back, sea levels rose again, and the long-term trend of 3 millimeters per year became clear. But for a year or two, it was exciting because something really interesting was going on.
I guess that's also totally consistent with what people have been seeing about regreeting of parts of Australia at the exact same time. And I never really thought about the fact that it has a longer storage capacity or a longer release time scale, and that itself could then have this effect on the vegetation in the area.
Yeah, absolutely. It's this huge sponge kind of just waiting to soak up a bunch of water.
I think that the issue of regional sea level rise is probably the most pressing one now. I feel like the global issues are relatively well understood, or at least in comparison to regional factors, they're well understood. What do you think are the main unknowns now in regional sea level rise at the global level in terms of trying to understand how it's happening right now and how it's going to be changing in the future?
There's a lot going on in the ocean that has longer timescales than we sort of anticipated. Maybe that's not fair. Some people will always say, I knew it all. But there are these very long timescale signals in the ocean. And so we have a super clear look at the ocean for the last 20, coming up on 25 years now from satellite altimeters. Mm-hmm. But some of the signals we're interested in are longer than that. That makes them very challenging to kind of understand. In the Pacific, for example, the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, or there's a bunch of different names for it.
The IPO or...
Right, IPO. It's essentially a redistribution of heat. So there's a thicker layer of warm water in the Western Pacific right now than there has been, and that's caused sea levels to rise there at 2 to 3 times the global rate.
Yeah, that just sticks out globally when you look at regional maps.
It's huge. It's huge. And there's some evidence that maybe some of that is not PDO. Maybe some of it is longer term human caused signals, but it's just too hard. It's really hard to tease them apart right now. In contrast, here on the west coast of the United States, we've had almost no sea level rise for 20 years. Hmm. In fact, it's kind of caused a little bit of complacency. We haven't really been dealing with the rates of sea level rise that the rest of the world has. Here in California and Oregon and Washington.
And then you have places like up in Alaska where you have the gravitational effects leading, in some cases, to lowering.
Right, right. And those are very local, and that happens when there's a big glacier sitting on your coastline and melting, and then the lack of weight on top of it, it just springs back up.
Yeah.
Of course, Alaska has these huge glaciers that are disappearing very rapidly. Further south, we've had this kind of, I don't want to use the hiatus word, because that got all charged. But we've had this period where there's been almost no sea level rise. If you look at the 20 or 25 year trend along the west coast of the United States, it's almost flat.
Hmm.
You know, we haven't really been dealing with the consequences of ocean warming and sea level rise. And now probably we're about to start. The Pacific Decadal Oscillation is showing signs that it's flipping.
Hmm.
That could mean that there's 2 or 3 times faster than average sea level rise here on the West Coast. That would be a big deal, because if that comes on top of an El Nino and then you get a high tide or a storm, then a lot of places are really going to be in trouble on the West Coast.
Already in San Francisco, when we get these really high tides, big chunks of the Embarcadero flood.
Yeah, I think the number that I remember is that in San Francisco, the 100-year flood happens every 10 years now.
Yeah. So I guess the larger point you're making is that if you're looking at regional sea level rise in any one location, at present, it's difficult to separate out the influences of cyclical climate variability from a secular trend. So you could think, oh, we have this accelerating sea level rise in this one area, but it's really just from a climate cycle, you know, classically, as we often talk about, superimposed on a long-term trend. So we're still at a phase where it's hard to make robust predictions at, let's say, a decadal level for any particular coastline. Is that fair to say, or do you have any more kind of optimism right now?
It's really tough to say in terms of decadal predictability for individual coastlines. I think we know something about the variability. It's usually 10 to 20 centimeters. We can kind of quantify the size of that variability.
From the tide gauge record, for example.
Exactly, exactly. And also now the altimeter, too. Mm-hmm. You know, it's 10 or 20 centimeters. As long as you're looking at timescales where the global number is also 10 centimeters or less, then decadal prediction is going to be tough. You know, we kind of know that the PDO is going to shift phases again at sometime in the next 20 years.
Right.
And we'll be looking at faster rates on the West Coast. And they'll be higher than the global average. Probably it'll be a couple millimeters a year, something like that.
It's a signal to noise question, like in detection and attribution. And in some areas where we now are able to quantify the noise enough sort of to understand the emergence of the signal.
Yes, exactly. But of course, you know, as you get out further into the 21st century, the big question is not really going to be the ocean anymore. It's going to be, what are the ice sheets doing? That's where we're really in the dark.
That's a great chance for a totally unplanned segue, which is in your ongoing OMG project. This is the Oceans Melting of Greenland project. What was the genesis of that particular proposal, and what's the current status?
The proposal started, gosh, I guess 4.5 years ago, something like that. We got funded last year and started work last year. This is a 5-year, $30 million NASA mission, essentially designed to answer the question, how much are the oceans contributing to the melt of Greenland?
And just for context, that's an unusually long and high value NASA project, I would say.
It is. It's part of this program called Earth Ventures, which was set up after the last decadal survey at NASA to encourage more PI-driven missions, essentially. And so there's a variety of different kinds. There's ones that are focused on building a new instrument. There's ones that are focused on very cheap satellites. And then there are the airborne missions like OMG, which are designed to use NASA's aircraft assets to answer directed science questions.
And you have a particular radar on board for OMG.
That's right, that's right. So we have actually 4 different observational surveys. We have the radar to measure the height of the ice. This is an interferometer, so we get this really nice swath of ice heights, and we're recording ice heights all the way around the perimeter of Greenland.
So you're not going to get monthly wall-to-wall coverage. That's simply impossible with an aircraft,
right?
Yeah.
It's going to be once per year, or it is once per year, but it is going to try and cover every marine terminating glacier in Greenland. So we're trying to get the last 5 to 10 kilometers of every glacier right where they meet the ocean all the way around Greenland.
And that's a lot of flight time.
It is. It is. It takes a couple of weeks to execute, 2 or 3. It's some 80, actually no, I think it's closer to 90 or 100 specific flight lines where we fly along a swath and capture we'll try and capture sort of a string of glaciers that are all in a line. Mm-hmm. But of course, the coastline of Greenland's very complicated, so we're always ducking in and going out, trying to set up this flight path that captures all of these things.
But you won't just have the altimeter data, you also have data from the ocean.
That's right. So we're doing the GLSEN data in the spring, and then in the fall, we come back in the same aircraft and we drop expendable CTDs from the airplane.
That's a conductivity, temperature, and depth, right?
That's right. That's right. In the spring, we drop these conductivity, temperature, and depth sensors. They fall from the airplane on a little parachute.
Nice.
Hit the water. Yeah, it's cool. And then they start transmitting. They talk directly to the aircraft. And then they drop essentially like an XBT probe, although it also measures salinity or conductivity as it falls. It falls through the water column, and then a little float stays at the top, continually transmitting the data back. After about 10 minutes, we've collected a full depth profile up on the shelf. The probes can go as deep as 1,000 meters. Most of our locations are a little shallower than that. Mm-hmm. But we will have seen top to bottom temperature and salinity measurements. And we do this about 250 times all the way around the coast of Greenland.
Wow.
And again, this is a once per year survey.
So when you get those profiles, is it just a snapshot or is it monitoring for a while?
Nope, it's just a single snapshot. In places where there are huge, very fast signals, we're mostly going to be measuring noise. But it turns out that in the deeper spots on the shelf, we think that there are these persistent signals that can actually last for several years. And kind of collect the warm water and then deliver it to the glaciers in these deep fjords.
We had a review article by Fiamma Sterneo a couple of years ago, and she's been publishing in that, as have others. And I suppose the idea is that warm water, for example, from the Irminger Current, could be coming up these fjords, delivering huge amounts of heat to the bottom of these glacial tongues and destabilizing them, which would then presumably lead to loss of buttressing strength and rapid retreat of the glaciers up into the interior. Is that kind of the overall scope of what you're trying to get a better handle on?
Yeah, that's exactly it. So Fiamma and a number of other researchers have looked really carefully in several fjords and seen this process happening, seen the glaciers retreating, seen the warm water entering. You get a sense of this kind of overturning where you have warm water going in down deep, and then cold, fresh water coming in, coming out of the fjord at the surface. Mm-hmm. And so you have this kind of little mini conveyor belt that's delivering heat to the bottom of the glacier.
But they're kind of just snapshots at a few locations where you have this vast perspective.
Right. So they're able to put up moorings and things and really look at the time evolution of one or two places. And what we're doing is exactly the opposite. We're taking a single once per year snapshot, but trying to look all the way around Greenland at the coastal waters and see if there are sort of large scale persistent signatures of this warm water getting on the shelf.
What disasters did you experience in the first year? there must have been some, right?
There's always a lot of paperwork to get started. Both NASA has us do a lot of paperwork, and then there are trying to get permission to do things. The real kind of disappointment in the first year, which was actually last year, was that we weren't able to do our CTD survey.
Oh.
There were a number of reasons, but it turned out that the manufacturer of the AXCTDs couldn't build them fast enough to get us off the ground.
Oh.
They couldn't build 250 for the first year's survey.
And that's kind of gutting.
That was disappointing. I was really hoping to get 2015 CTD survey from the plane, but it just wasn't in the cards.
But you flew the plane anyway.
We didn't actually fly the plane until 2016. We flew the plane for GLSEN in March of this year, and then we flew the AXCTD mission in September and the early part of October of this year.
Okay. Do you have any preliminary results that are ready for sharing, or is it sort of still in the collection analysis stage?
We do. Actually, Ian Finty is going to give, he's got a poster. I've got a poster at AGU. Ian's going to put up my poster for me because I'm not going, but don't tell AGU, okay? Ian Finty, one of my colleagues on OMG, is going to give a press workshop. NASA's covering several of the other Earth Ventures missions that just started this year.
Okay.
OMG is one of them. And he's going to show some early results. It's interesting, actually, there's one set of fjords on the East Coast called Scoresby. And I was digging through the literature and I found there was a ship survey of this fjord system in 1990.
Huh.
Of course, this is only just two data points, 1990 and 2016, but after 26 years, it was about 1 degree warmer, not just at the surface, but all the way to the bottom of this 700 or 800 meter deep fjord.
That's a big number. That's a lot of heat.
It's a lot of heat. It's definitely enough to melt a lot of glacier stuff.
Let me just play devil's advocate on the Greenland data. The devil's advocate approach would say that this sort of ocean ice interaction is a transient phenomenon, and that soon all of these glaciers are going to become non-marine grounded, and that then it'll just become a surface mass balance question, and that we're wasting time by looking at the ocean ice interactions.
Actually, every time they kind of come out with a new bed topography of Greenland, they find another big chunk of glacier that's grounded below sea level. So the ocean ice interactions might go on longer than we thought.
Yeah, I totally agree.
And account for more ice than we thought. It's definitely worth pursuing. And although the analogies only go so far, of course, ocean ice interactions in Antarctica are potentially much bigger and could account for huge quantities of ice melt.
And they'll be going on in Antarctica for centuries.
That's right. Likewise, in Antarctica, every time you turn around, they find another big chunk of ice that's grounded below sea level. Another thing that Ian's going to talk about is we have a special issue of Oceanography magazine that's coming out, I think, today or sometime next week during AGU. It's got 11 or 12. I should know this because I'm the guest editor. I'm one of the guest editors.
Who tracks these things?
Right, who can tell? It's got about a dozen articles on ocean ice interaction. One of them is Ian's. There's a couple other that have OMG-related stuff. Fiamma has one. It really covers a very broad array of Greenland activity and Antarctic research. It's interesting, but as I was reading through all the articles trying to write the introduction, I was really struck by how almost every time there's some big news, surprising result, it's bad news. There's more ice at risk and sea level rise potential than we thought. It was a little sobering.
You know, one point of optimism that I found in that literature, mostly for Antarctica, maybe you can comment on this for Greenland, but is that the mitigation potentials are just enormous over centennial scales in Antarctica. If you're looking at the low end emission scenarios, you could be having no change in mass from Antarctica. Whereas if you're looking at RCP 8.5, it could be something like 15 meters. So there's this incredible range of possibilities from mitigation scenarios. Is it different in Greenland with the extreme warming we've had in the Arctic? Is more of the melt cooked into the system already there?
My understanding of the scenarios is that even 2 degrees warming will ultimately melt all of Greenland. Now, the question is really how fast?
Yeah.
As an ice sheet, it was very close to balance, or maybe that's not the right way. It was close to the tipping point when we started the warming. It's probably in a lot greater danger than Antarctica. That said, one of the articles that I read that's in the special issue actually just identified or discussed some recent work that identified huge parts of East Antarctica that are also grounded below sea level.
Yeah.
And that are also seem to be experiencing ocean ice interaction and melt from below, and that there's enough ice, there's essentially 19 meters of sea level equivalent locked away in the basins that are at risk there.
It's pretty scary.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, we've been kind of thinking, well, 3 meters from West Antarctica and Greenland, but Greenland's going to melt slow, and that's it. But now there's another 19 meters that are kind of on the table. Of course, none of that was accounted for in the last IPCC assessment.
No, no. So. One of the great things that NASA can bring to the table for this kind of research is their, you know, I think fairly unique combination of this incredible engineering community, the ability to launch satellite and aircraft platforms, and then to fund curiosity-driven science within the same agency. And I know you probably get, there's no real news at present, but with the coming change in administration and the announcements that have been made, maybe the best question to just ask is like, what's morale like in the agency? How are people feeling? Is there a feeling of panic, or are people just thinking, okay, we're going to get through this?
I think everyone's bracing themselves to see what happens next. For me personally, I think the uncertainty is almost as bad as bad news.
Yeah,
because we don't know how to prepare. It seems unlikely to me that all of Earth science is just going to get, or all of climate science is just going to get canceled at NASA in year one of a Trump administration. But nevertheless, there's concern. I think I'm certainly have thought hard about what all this means. But in short, we just don't know. We don't know what they plan to do, and kind of the typical indicators that you get from a candidate when they're still a candidate about what they want to do with NASA and climate change don't seem to be reliable in this case. And so I don't really know how to deal with that.
Yeah. I've heard from NASA colleagues that NASA is under more direct control from the White House than other agencies are, and that because of that, there can be fairly abrupt changes in direction, as there were under Bush 2 when we had the Moon, Mars, and Beyond campaign that was then abruptly ended. Does NASA, in fact, have this potential to have major structural changes essentially overnight?
Like any federal agency, I think there's some inertia in NASA. Really changing overnight is hard. I mean, if you have a satellite, for example, that's 75% built and you've already spent hundreds of millions of dollars on it, does it really make financial sense to cancel it at that point? I think in that sense, missions and projects that are already underway, it'll be tough to justify canceling them. Of course, there are jobs involved as well. I think it's hard to imagine it being an overnight change.
Yeah.
But that said, it is theoretically possible. NASA administrator is chosen by the president and can have a pretty big influence on, obviously, on NASA's execution of its missions. So we'll just have to wait and see. But I think it can be more abrupt than changes in other agencies where Congress is really exerting a lot stronger influence, like NOAA, for example.
Yeah, and like NOAA or NSF would be a little bit harder to change the rudder quickly on those agencies, I think.
Right.
Well, here's the hoping that it ends that it ends up being, you know, not as dire as it seems like it might be, and that you're able to consider and that you're able to continue on in particular with OMG, which sounds like an amazing project.
Absolutely. I'm really excited about it. The crew from the plane this year that I spent the better part of 5 weeks with deployed in in Greenland and Iceland were really fantastic. They were just top-notch at what they did, and we're all very excited about the science. You know, the neat part of being on the mission was that we all had the same goal.
Yeah.
We're really all on the same mission, and that mission was to do this big science experiment, and it was very exciting and fun.
Josh, thanks a lot for the chat. Really appreciate it.
You bet. And of course, I have to get this in there. There's always omg.jpl.nasa.gov if you want to find out more about OMG.
And also on Josh's personal webpage, there's a lot of, I think probably all of Josh's papers are there, and a brief CV. Hey, Josh, thanks again.
Thank you, Michael. Really great to talk to you.
That was my interview with Josh Willis from the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Josh, thanks a lot for the conversation. As always, the opinions here are mine and those of my guests, not necessarily those of Nature or Nature's publishers. If you like the show, you know, you can get it through subscriptions on iTunes, Google Play Music, and Stitcher. Comments always welcome, especially on iTunes, helps to bump up the visibility of the show to those who are looking for content like this. You can also reach me through email at forecastpod@gmail.com, or you can leave comments on the show notes, which are at forecastpod.org. On Twitter, I'm at MWClimateSci. Talk to you soon.